You're listening to Rick Kleffel, the Agony Column podcast. You can find additional reviews, interviews, print interviews, and book commentary 5 days a week at trashotron.com/agony. I'm speaking with Alan Chews. He's NPR's Voice of Books. His latest work of nonfiction is A Trance After Breakfast. His latest work of fiction is Song of Slaves in the Desert. Thank you for joining me, Alan.
Always a pleasure, Rick.
We have three wonderful new thrillers out to talk about.
It's one of those great times, isn't it?
It's amazing.
Back to back to back.
Not only are they totally engrossing and entertaining, I think these books are getting some pretty high levels of literary quality in here.
Yes, absolutely. This is not schlock. This is really terrific, ready to wear.
And the first let's talk about is Anne Rice's The Wolf Gift, which I have to say, I think it's her best book ever.
I actually would agree with that. Yeah, I mean, I like some of the earlier vampire books because she really distinguished herself as a stylist in those books.
And she had a really great take on them, too. Her take on the vampire was completely unique. But I think in the ensuing X years, her writing skill has evolved. Her ability to come up with an absolutely gripping plot has evolved.
Yes. Well, I just want to add this little parenthetical note before we go on to talk about this terrific book, except for those Jesus novels, which I thought were absolutely dismal, dismal failures. And I guess came out of a kind of troubled life situation. In the way the vampire books came out of the death from leukemia of her of a child, of a young child. It was many, many, many years ago, and she became an expert on blood, and she wrote the vampire novels. Then her husband died of a brain tumor some years ago, and she, who had left the church, went back to the church, and I think those two novels based on the Gospels came out of that situation. And she since left the church. She says she's still a Christian, but she left the Catholic Church again and has given us this vampire novel, which I hope is a werewolf, which I hope is a werewolf series.
I agree. I haven't read the Jesus books. I have an embargo on.
Well, you know, I'm a huge, huge fan of Norman Mailer's work, but I have to say, you know, The Gospel According to the Son, which he wrote as a kind of tribute to his wife's Gentile family, his last wife's Gentile family, was a dismal failure. And these books of Rice's are even worse than Mailer's try at rewriting the gospel. So
I think we'll just leave that to the ancients and get on with The Wolf Gift, which is superb.
I can't say that her Jesus books were real howlers. Okay, I've said it.
You said it. The Wolf Gift is successful on so many levels. It has a lot of the things that people look for in Anne Rice. It has lush settings. It has a kind of a nicely, slightly over-the-top romance going in it, and a couple of them, actually.
Yeah.
We have a good-looking hero, and I have to tell you that when you give me a guy who's rich and handsome and talented, my inclination as a character is to hate the guy, but she managed to make him likable, and that was, I thought, a real accomplishment, at least for me as a reader.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that. I also like the setting. I mean, she shifted away from New Orleans to Northern California,
San Francisco, and the
coastline north of it.
She did a great job at rendering it. That's right in my neck of the woods, and I thought she nailed all the people. She nailed the places. She nailed the feel.
Yep.
She got the gothic feel out of it.
Yeah.
And once we get to the plot aspect of this book, it's really spectacular. She manages to keep ramping it up again and again. Some nice twists on you know, the whole superhero genre, and that's really unexpected.
Yes. I mean, she's in each of these series, she's got a kind of an impromptu council, right? Whether vampires or witches, and she's got an impromptu werewolf council going here towards the end of this novel, which means they're probably going to continue their adventures, playing a certain role in society, which...
thinning the herd.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I don't think we want to give away anything more than that.
No, no, it's well worth anybody's, any reader's valuable reading time. It's fun, it's exciting, it's very well written. I think it's, when I pick up a book, that's what I look for.
Yeah, and once again, I just want to reiterate, you know, she's working at her highest level here, as she was in the early Vampire Chronicle novels.
Mm-hmm.
Bounced back from the dismal failure of the Christian novels, and I'm really looking forward to another decade of terrific Anne Rice books coming out about werewolves.
And I don't know if you know this, I talked to her, and she mentioned that this was originally pitched, she originally pitched this as a TV series.
Oh, really? Oh, I'm glad she didn't do it.
You know, no, I think it came out fabulous as a novel, and I hope if they do it, they do it right as a movie or a couple of movies or all Game of Thrones.
Uh-huh. Well, we'll see.
We'll see.
But for now, you got this terrific novel.
And it's well worth reading.
It's always, I mean, you know, movies have their own special charms, but... I mean, the great thing about reading good fiction is that you produce the movie in your mind and you throw it on the screen of your imagination, and doesn't cost you more than the price of the book and however long it takes you to read it, whereas movies are a little bit expensive these days.
Well, also, too, I think by virtue of the fact that you do all that creative work yourself, it's more memorable. The best books are, I can go back and visit scenes in that Anne Rice novel, in The Wolf Gift, as if there are things I'd done myself. And there are things I couldn't possibly do, and many of them I really wouldn't want to do.
You mean you can't leap from rooftop to rooftop across San Francisco?
No, but I can remember doing it as Anne Rice's character. That's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, I know. That's the great thing about fiction, isn't it? We chased Moby Dick and lived to survived to tell the...
And we went up the river with Huck Finn. That's why we read. And another great example of that is Tobias Buckle's Arctic Rising.
But, you know, on that point, though, I mean, we live in a... I live in a kind of dream world, you know. I go from writing my own fiction in the morning to reading other people's fiction in the afternoon and late evenings, and then I go to sleep and I dream. Real life plays an important role in my consciousness, but it's not the only thing.
Well, I think that's why people who read are often accused of, you know, living in a dream world. That's been said of me more times than I care to admit, and to a degree, it's true.
Yeah, but it's a wonderful thing.
It's it's a skill.
And remember what Calderón de la Barca says, la vida es sueño, yo sueño, sueño son. Life is a dream of a dream. Tobias Buckle, Arctic Rising, I know.
Global warming, yes. And global warming taking over turned into a page-turning thriller. And Tobias Buckle has always displayed in his novels something that's not often found in either the thriller genre or the science fiction genre, which is admirable brevity.
Yeah.
Does not. This is not like a 500-page tome.
Mm-hmm.
It's a quick read, but it's immaculately conceived.
Mm-hmm.
The characters are great. The premise seems pretty terrifying.
Yes, but at the same time, it shows us that whatever crisis emerges, I mean, we mustn't say the sky is falling, you know, if the oceans are rising, we deal with them,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right? We just treat, you know, we've got the appropriate technology to deal with at least aspects, major aspects of such crises. You know, there's an international team of of cops that patrols the rising waters of the Arctic because of the melting icebergs.
Well, I think, too, that it's nice to see somebody who comes out of the world of science fiction applying themselves to the world of these kind of thrillers, near-future thrillers, because there's a lot of this kind of, I think, Heinleinian rigor in this, and Heinleinian vigor as well.
Yes.
That the logic is well worked out. The mechanics of all this stuff, you know, it makes a lot of sense what happens here.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want to give too much away, but it does involve the potential, the end of the world, just around the corner.
Right, but it's clear that, I mean, books like this show us that the end of the world is not the end of the world. It's the end of a certain way of living in the world, but not the end.
You know, that's an interesting observation, because apocalyptic thrillers then kind of become more novels of transformation, of global transformation, not just novels of, you know, survival. And I think that's where this is different from many novels of the same genre.
Yeah.
That it's not just a who's going to live, but how are we going to work this out?
Yes. This is the way the world ends. Not with a bang, but with an international Arctic patrol that deals with the question of rising seas.
And a lovely book to read. That is, I think, you know, a beginning of a new career. And it's interesting to see where Tor is going, because they've been known primarily as a science fiction house, but they've really been pushing on their thrillers and their mysteries of late, and they've been doing some top quality work.
Yeah. Yeah, which brings us to The New Lincoln Child, which should have been published by Tor, but I guess they've given him over to Doubleday.
And well, maybe Doubleday has a little bit more muscle than Tor, because this is a book that seems like destined for the big screen, and it's totally enjoyable. It's, I think, Child's best book. I would say it's Child's best book on his own yet, myself. As well,
It is quite terrific. I mean, it is one of those novels. It's really in the Michael Crichton tradition, which is a movie on the page.
Mm-hmm. And it's essentially what we have here is The Mummy for the 21st century.
Right, the Mummy, as opposed to the Daddy, as it turns out. Right?
Yeah, and I think. One of the things I think that underlies this book that and makes it good in its way, dial back into the background, I think you have here a lot of the influence of Lovecraft. Lovecraft had, you know, written more than a couple of short stories set in Egypt. And I think that feeling of something big and ancient coming through, I mean, that's a Lovecraft trademark. And I think... Preston plays that well into the 21st century.
Yes, I think that's true. I think he, because finally there you can rationalize the end here, as some of the characters try to do. But
one of the things I like too about Child is that even though there is, as you say, there are some attempts at rationalization, he really lets this be a novel of the supernatural. There's not a lot of hemming and hawing about that, and I think that. Two, we have, this is clearly the beginning of a series, tentpole for a series, and I really like the main character. I think that, you know, an enigmaologist.
Right.
Who doesn't want to be an enigmaologist?
Yeah. He's going to have some interesting cases to crack as the Child goes along writing these books.
It's really, I think, entertaining. It's smart, and it has, you know, it's authentically scary in a few places, and that's hard to pull off again in the 21st century when we know so much. But it's interesting how much this harkens back to all the classic, you know, Egyptian horror novels and Egyptian horror movies, and you know, the true life Egyptian horrors. You know,
yes, and I mean, it's just he plants it so well. I mean, you know, the moment our enigmologist gets to this massive swamp in the south of Egypt near the Sudanese border, that before too long, our hero is going to be below the swamp, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, sorry about that.
Yeah. You know, before too long, our hero is going to be in the swamp.
And one of the things I think that is great is how unexpected, you know, how out of all of these kind of standard issue, I guess, you know, almost tropes, genre tropes, the Egyptian horror genre tropes, a child plays with those. He turns them upside down. He turns them inside out. And he gives us, you know, a rockin' adventure. And and also a good character. I like the guy, you know. And that's the characters are, you know, and all the characters are, you know, complex enough and interesting enough to make us want to come back and see them again.
Yeah. It's a real triumph. Child is working at the top of his powers. He hasn't yet succumbed to any religious motives the way Anne Rice did for a while. We'll see what happens with him, but it seems as though we have a lot to look forward to from these writers.
Yeah, and again, it's so interesting to see the thriller genre retain its, you know, appeal, its page-turning appeal to be a books that are, you know, fun and entertaining and really engrossing to read, but to have a pretty significant level of literary reward too. You know, good characters, good prose.
Yes, especially good prose.
Yeah, and also just, I think, you know, the kind of plot architecting that goes on in these novels is really pretty sophisticated. It's not just, you know, A to B kind of stuff.
Yes, what I really love is the polarities of state-of-the-art technology on the one hand, and deep, deep, serious menace out of the longest to go past.
Yeah, well, that and you know, those are things that we're, you know, facing right now. The Buckle book is a great example of that. You know, we have all this state-of-the-art technology, but it's really the past in terms of, you know, inevitable climate change. Maybe we brought it upon ourselves, but that too is a confrontation with a certain kind of evil.
Yeah, or maybe worse than evil. Maybe it's just natural.
Natural.
Yeah. Evil we can hate. Nature we can't.
Yeah, yeah. Nature, we're just part of the food chain. Unfortunately, we're not at the top anymore. I've been speaking with Alan Shoes. His latest novel is Song of Slaves in the Desert. Alan, you have a couple of new titles coming out. Why don't you talk a little bit about this? This is pretty exciting stuff.
Yes, I've got my first ebook coming out in late June. It's a trio of novellas, and its title comes from the title of the first novella. It's called Paradise or Eat Your Face. And that comes in late June. I'm really looking forward to shepherding that through. We're just starting to read proof on that now, and we've got a cover, and I hope people will go to their favorite websites and take a look at it.
Now, you know, I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about this. You've been working in the novella genre here for a while, and I think that's a really interesting and powerful genre because it gives you... in the hands of somebody like you and in the hands of a good writer, it gives you the ability to give us the kind of the rich reading experience of a novel, but with a lot more punch.
Well, I mean, what you say sounds right. I mean, I really don't think about trying that to do exactly that as when I'm working on something. It just seems like I write and write and write, and then it comes out longer than a story and shorter than a novel. But I have published half a dozen novellas now over the last, 10 years. And fortunately, all of them have come out in print in the magazines. Especially the Idaho Review has done three of them. Thanks be the gods for shining their favor on the Idaho Review. And now I published a pair of them about 5 years ago in a little volume called The Fires, and now this, Paradise, or Eat Your Face, will bring out another three. So I'm really lucky guy that I can not just write these things, but get them into book form, whether published actual book made of paper or, in this case, an e-book. think the publisher intends to print about 200 or 300 copies of a kind of a collectible version of this in print form, which he'll sell, or maybe will sell at readings and such.
That sounds great. I love getting these kind of super limited editions, and it's nice to have something in print. But it's also, I think, these days, the latest generation of e-readers, it's a lot easier. They're a lot easier to deal with than the first generations.
Yeah, this is 180 pages, three novellas, 180 pages, and interesting work. I hope it'd be interesting to people. The thing is, there's a Santa Fe Writers Project who's doing this. They did that pair of novellas. Now they're doing Paradise. It belongs to the Independent Publishers Group, and the Independent Publishers Group and Amazon are now at war, because Amazon wanted to take a larger margin of sales from them, and IPG said no. And so Amazon said, well, we're not going to sell your books at our website. So you'll be able to get that. As of now, you'll be able to get this book through Barnes & Noble, get it on the Nook, probably even on a Kindle Fire, and from websites at various bookstores. But it won't, as of now, it's not a, won't be available at Amazon. But the publisher, Andrew Gifford, seems to think that they may have formed some kind of a truce by September or October.
Well, we'll see. That's a very interesting event, because I know now Amazon has also recently launched a science fiction and horror imprint.
I haven't seen any of those. I have reviewed one of their Icelandic series, and I know they have a European series, and they're launching a biography series. But I haven't seen any science fiction and horror.
They have some intriguing what looks to be some intriguing offerings. I might say, I've been very leery of anything, just because there's a plethora of great stuff elsewhere.
Yeah,
I mean, the challenge for those of us who are in the reviewing business is to get the cream of the crop that people won't have like fired at them with a cannon via the bestseller lists and the bookstores.
Yes, we're trying to do our own bestseller list here.
That's right, best reading list.
Yeah.
I've been speaking with Alan Chews. His latest book is Song of Slaves in the Desert. His latest work of nonfiction is A Trance After Breakfast. He is NPR's Voice of Books. Thank you for joining me, Alan.
A great pleasure, as always, Rick.
You're listening to Rick Kleffel, the Agony Column podcast. You can find additional reviews, interviews, print interviews, and book commentary 5 days a week at trashotron.com/agony.